Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're joined by adventurer and mycologist Danny Hollowaters, PhD. Danny holds a bachelor in veterinary sciences, a master of science in biology, and a PhD in organismic and evolutionary biology. During his master's program, he developed a new technology to analyze forensically relevant fungi in casework at the Netherlands Forensic Institute. Between 2012 and 2018, he worked at the Farlow Herbarium of the Harvard University Herbaria as a PhD student. In 2018, he did a short postdoc at the University of South Bohemia in the Czech Republic. And then from November 2018 until late in 2020, he was a USDA-funded postdoctoral research assistant at Purdue University, where he worked on characterizing the fungal microbiota of romaine lettuce. Currently, he works at Ghent University as a junior postdoctoral fellow on a project dealing with Labubinieles associated with bat flies. In addition to all this academic work, he writes popular science articles for different sources around the world. And since the very beginning of his student career at Ghent University in Belgium, he has loved the interdisciplinary research in biology. That probably contributed to his choice to study the ectoparasitic Labubinieles fungus. I'm excited to learn more about that unique order of organisms, as well as the secrets of other little-known parasitic fungi. Danny, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure, of course. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm extremely excited to have you because in reading your research, you're one of the mycologists who, even with mysterious organisms like fungi, completely blows my mind. And I realize I know little to nothing about the organisms you research. So I'm excited to learn more about Labubinieles, some of the other fungi that you've worked with. What got you interested in science? And then what got you interested in fungal organisms?
I think it was my mother who got me interested in nature overall. She always took me on daily walks with our dog. And we just used to, you know, talk about nature all the time, really, when we were on those walks. And so I was immersed in nature from a young age. And so I realized from a young age that I wanted to be a vet, which is why I started veterinary medicine studies. But when I was finally doing those studies, I realized I don't want to be a vet. And so there was just too much hospital work involved. And so my big dream was to be working, you know, with the African Big Five and to be a veterinarian and in field expeditions. But before I was able to do that, I would have to do a lot of hospital work. And I really wasn't excited about that. So that's why I switched to biology and to mycology in the end. So when I went to Ghent University to do a general bachelor and master's in biology, one of the first professors I met was Annemieke Verbeke, who is a mycologist. And so she really gave me her love for fungi. That's how I got into mycology.
So you went from wanting to study some of the biggest organisms on the planet to some of the smallest.
That's true. Yep.
In exploring all the different mushroom and fungi species, you know, in reading your CV, the breadth of your work is kind of mind-blowing as well. How did you end up with a fascination for parasitic fungi, an ectoparasitic fungi?
My first research project dealt with Lactarius, the milky mushrooms.
Sure.
And that was fine. It was, you know, working on a description of species. It was fine, but I wasn't, you know, excited or passionate about it. I don't think I would have been able to do a PhD on those things. But then, so for my master's, I still wanted to work with Mika, so with my professor who got me into mycology. But I asked her, can you give me something that's more, you know, where I will have more work on, something that's more difficult, something where I will have to do a lot of work in to crack the code, so to speak. And so she told me, well, there's one project that you can work on. You can work on Labubinieles. Nobody's really, you know, gotten molecular protocols to work. The taxonomy is a a mess. The classification hasn't been figured out very well. So yeah, that's a great project. And I was like, oh, sure, I'll do it. And so my master's project, sadly, was a bit of a disaster. Everything failed from my first chapter where I was supposed to develop these molecular techniques to be able to extract DNA and generate DNA sequences for members of Labo Benielis. That was all a failure. Then my second chapter, I had a project where I was looking for Labo Benielis fungi on insects that visit dead carcasses, which was kind of an interesting microhabitat. And I learned a lot about decomposition and the insects that visit these, you know, carcass decomposition islands. Right. But we found nothing of interest for Labo Benielis world, at least. And then my third chapter, I started screening insects in a museum in the Netherlands, in Tilburg. And I luckily found some insects that were infected by these fungi. And then we worked on describing their morphology. There were no new species, but some of them were interesting records or new records for the Netherlands. So all in all, the master's thesis was mostly a failure, but it really made that I got intrigued by these organisms, frustrated as well, which is never a good thing for me, and a bit passionate as well. Like, and especially the collaboration with the people in the Netherlands, Paul van Wieling and his colleagues in the museum. That collaboration really, it's still standing, and we still publish papers together, and the project in the Netherlands is actually still ongoing as well. So it started off as a small thing, but you know, meanwhile we've described species, new species from the Netherlands, from that small nature area where we're doing research.
Well, and I know in reading your biographical information, that's one of the most exciting things for you, is when different disciplines of science have that crosstalk where you're able to learn from entomologists, and they're able to learn from you as a mycologist. That's some of the most exciting parts of doing this work for you.
Yes, I enjoy interacting with researchers from different fields. So mostly I interact with entomologists. But for my work, where I study Labo Benielis that are associated with bat flies, I also interact with mammalogists. So the bat flies are parasites of bats. And so I go out to the field and capture bats. And that really makes that I need to interact with bat researchers as well, which is quite exciting. So it was the day before, on Friday, I was involved in NASPR talk, the North American Society for Bat Research. And I gave a talk about this system, this tripartite system. But it's quite exciting because these bat people, they don't know nothing about fungi, except maybe for the white nose syndrome. But otherwise, they know nothing about fungi on bat flies. They barely know something about bat flies. So it's quite exciting to bring those different fields together with some of my work.
Well, and fungi are so notorious at being participants in all these different symbioses and being embedded on every organism or piece of organic matter on the planet. I'm even learning about fungi that permeate the air all around us. So, you know, mycologists have this unique ability to kind of link all these different disciplines together. And as we learn more and more in that vein, we're seeing how connected everything is. So as a mycologist, that ends up getting to be, it sounds like, the role you get to play is connecting all these different fields of biological research.
What can I say? You summarized this perfectly.
I guess we should get into then Labo Benielis. Sure. You know, I'm just barely able to pronounce it, much less understand what the organism is. So what is this order of fungi?
So the Labo Benielis are an order of, you know, about 2,000 and a little bit species in 145 genera. They're microscopic in size. They're ectoparasites, which means that they occur at the outside of the host. Their hosts are always arthropods, mostly true insects, but also mites and opilionis. What are opilionis? Harvest men, daddy long legs.
Daddy long legs. Okay.
Yeah. As I mentioned before, their taxonomy and their classification are pretty much entirely unresolved. What's really interesting about them is that they don't form a mycelium. They don't form hyphae and no mycelium. Instead, they form these non-hyphal three-dimensional thalli, we call them, fruiting bodies of up to a few thousand cells. It all starts with a single ascospore that consists of two cells. And then through mitotic divisions, a three-dimensional thallus exists. And so they're microscopic in size, these level B neolis. Mostly they're about 100 to 200 micrometers in length. The largest one that's been observed is about 2 millimeters in length, but that's really very rare to see those. And the ascospores are only transmitted, or almost only transmitted, through contacts between the hosts. So they're very short-lived in the environment.
I mean, that bends all of our traditional notions of what makes a fungi. I guess the one defining characteristic that carries through that kind of helps us place these order of organisms into kingdom fungi is the fact they reproduce the spores. Are there any other defining characteristics that make them fungi as opposed to something else?
Oh boy, I haven't even thought about that. That's a great question. When they were described for the first time, or when they were observed for the first time in the 1840s, researchers thought they were just hairs of insects. And then later, they were described as parasitic plants. In the 1850s, there was a researcher who described them as acanthocephalon worms, which is even, you know, further from anything that a fungus could be.
Right.
So in the end, it was really DNA studies that placed them in the fungi. Well, DNA studies and ultrastructural characters. But the DNA studies were quite important to, without any doubt, place them within the Ascomycota.
I mean, fungi already blur biological boundaries, but especially this organism, as I read about it, it's hard to know what to do. So thank you for giving us some kind of anchor or mooring. Yes, the genetic information, place them into kingdom fungi. Now, how many people are looking at these organisms? Because just from this little bit we've been talking about them, clearly they challenge a lot of conventional notions of biology in certain ways. How many people are looking into studying this order of organisms?
Well, yes. So like you mentioned, they're hard to study. They're microscopic in size. DNA extraction and PCR amplification have been, you know, notoriously difficult and mostly unsuccessful. Culturing attempts have been mostly unsuccessful. Well, always unsuccessful. And so that's probably the reason, or among the reasons, that they are so poorly studied. And I would say around the world currently, there's probably a handful that are dedicating their life to studying the level B neolis. But there's more people who know about them. So, and there is a number of collaborators that I work with who help me in some of my work, but who don't necessarily study them themselves.
Right.
But yeah, one of my goals, and I suppose, is to get them out of the shadows a bit more, that more mycologists will consider them as fungi and not these oddities.
Right. In fleshing these out and fleshing this order of organisms out, you just hinted at the difficulty we could have in describing them and even working with them because they are so small. Do we have any definition in terms of species? And I know in your work that I've read, you focused on what we call the Hesperomyces species complex. I guess, how well defined are species in this order of Labubinielis? And then maybe we can get into, you know, if there's host specificity between species, what differentiates them, all that kind of thing.
Ooh, big question.
Yeah, I think I wrapped about five questions in one there.
Yes, I think so. That's great. That's fine. Species in Label B neolis are defined by morphological characters, mostly, with the exception of maybe five. And so some of my work these days is focused on testing those morphological species limits to find out if DNA characters confirm those morphologically defined taxa, or whether we should revise some of these taxa. And so for Hesperomyces fluorescens, which was described on a North American ladybird, but since description been, you know, found on many, many ladybirds around the world, I found using DNA data that it is actually a complex of multiple species, and every species seems to have its own host. And I think the host specificity in Hesperomyces virescens, at least, is at the level of genus, because we know that specimens of Hesperomyces from Adelia bipunctata and Adelia decimpunctata, the two-spot and the 10-spot ladybird, they are identical. So I think, you know, all the Adelia associated Hesperomyces virescensis are one and the same species. And we know that all of the Hesperomyces on Harmonia, the invasive ladybird, Harmonia exuvius, also represent the same species. And then all the Hesperomyces thalli from Asia, it's another ladybird I collected in Panama, also represent a single species. And so we know that all of these different ladybirds host their own species of Hesperomyces now. But one of the problems often in taxonomy is that you can't just start describing these species. You need to go back in time and figure out on what host the species was originally described. And so in my case, it was Chylocorus stigma. And when I published my paper on Hesperomyces virescens, where I introduced this species as a complex of species, I didn't have specimens of Chylocorus stigma yet. So I wasn't able to describe these new species that I know exist within the complex formally, because I need to know which one is the original Hesperomyces virescens sensu stricto, the one that, you know, was originally described. It must be one of the species within the complex, but I wasn't, of course, sure which one it was. Luckily, you know, a little after our publication, one of my colleagues from Florida emailed me saying, oh yeah, I have a number of specimens of Chylocorus with Hesperomyces. He mailed them to me. I sequenced them and they form their own phylogenetic clade and their own phylogenetic species. So now I know this one phylogenetic species is what was, or what Roland Taxa, when he described Hesperomyces virescens, what he intended with that species. And all of the other clades I have in my phylogenetic tree are now, with confidence, new species that I need to describe. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Well, and I think you've brought up something which is really interesting, and that is when you're working with organisms like this, I would imagine there'd be some challenge in even finding specimens that are host to the organism to verify some of this information, right?
Yes, that's one of the major challenges. You can have, in the field of Lavoie Beniellis, great questions. But the problem is that you need to find the hosts before you can find the Lavoie Beniellis on which you have the questions, right? Right. And so one of the questions I have is whether Arthrorhynchus eucalyptipodae, that's a bat fly associated fungus, follows that same pattern of Hesperomyces virescens, whether it is host specific, whether, you know, one thallus of Arthrorhynchus eucalyptipodae on one host is different or the same species compared to another thallus from a different host species. The problem is that the prevalence of Arthrorhynchus on these bat flies is probably between 2 and 3%. So you need to catch a lot of bat flies before you have 2 or 3 in your data set with a fungus that you can sequence. And then you have to be lucky, because one of the hosts where it occurs on that I'm interested in to sequence thalli from is very rare. Like, it's a very rare host on its own, and it's a very rare it's a very rare host to Lavoie Beniellis. So yes, it becomes challenging. I now have a small phylogenetic tree with 4 isolates of Arthrorhynchus eucalyptipodae that really confirms my hypothesis. But of course, it's preliminary because it's only 4 isolates. However, it took me around 4 or more years to generate those data.
And is the Arthrorhynchus essentially a species complex that you're mapping like the Hesperomyces?
Yes, that's the idea. But for Hesperomyces, I have hundreds of isolates, whereas for Arthrorhynchus, I have like 10 in total for 2 species. So the one species, I don't know what is going on with that species yet, because the data is just it's a bit strange what the results are or what the results are showing. But the other species is really clearly, or really clearly seems to be a complex as well that's host specific. So I call it a species complex consisting of different species segregated by host.
Right. So the host actually may be the defining feature of the species. And in reading your work, there are some really vivid depictions of capturing Arthuricus. So I want to get into that as well. Take us on some of these expeditions to actually capture these elusive bats that play host to the elusive bugs that then play host to the elusive fungi. Maybe we can start with the work there in Chicanti in Panama.
Sure. So my work in Panama started in 2015 when I was planning to visit STRIDE, the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. But somehow it didn't feel right to just visit STRIDE. I wanted to visit a local university. So I got involved with UNACHI, the Universidad Autónoma de Chiriquí, which is in the highlands of the province of Chiriquí, around Volcán Barú, close to Costa Rica. My work there led to this really amazing collaboration with a number of people in UNACHI. But my work in STRI also led to me getting to know Guido Berghido, who is the owner of the natural preserve of Chucanti in the province of the Darién. So the Darién is this one region where the Pan-American Highway is, you know, not continuing. So it's just plain rainforest, which is great, right? Because it's a lot of primary rainforest. And in Chucanti, we had the chance to collect specimens, both fungi, a general fungal survey, as well as capture bats. So basically what I did was, this was a 3-month period of fieldwork that I had planned in Panama, in Gamboa and Barro Colorado with STRI, in David with the UNACHI people, and then in Cerro Chucanti with a number of assistants that I had invited to come collect with me. So the day when we left for the expedition started really early at 6 a.m. when we went to the house and finalized arrangements, which was a bit stressful for me as organizer, but that's how Panamanian people do it, and it works just fine. So the trip was finally arranged. We left for Panama City. We drove with a 4x4 to, you know, get into the Darién. And then we went to the first city, and then we had to walk the rest of the day. We had a few horses that carried the backpacks, not all of them, but some, and the food, because there's nothing happening on that mountain. So we had a cook. We had a boy who helped his mother, who was a cook. And then we had a few guides. And then there was me and then my field assistants. And we climbed the whole day. And there's even a video that I posted on YouTube showing how muddy the mountain was. So my friend and collaborator Jasmine, she multiple times fell into the mud trying to just keep on climbing, knee deep, I should say. My other collaborator and field assistant Lauren fell down multiple times, like completely in the mud, which was interesting. And so it took us probably around, you know, the whole day. I think me and Jasmine arrived at midnight because I didn't want to leave members at the end. So I stayed with Jasmine. So it was midnight when we had our dinner. So, you know, from 6 a.m. to midnight, we traveled to our field site, which was challenging. But on the next day, then we were all super excited to get into the field, because there you are on a cloud forested mountain in the middle of the cloud forest. So it was great. We collected fungi during the day, and at night we went to scout sites, set up mist nets, and capture bats. We set out nets around sunset, and we probably set around 4 nets that were 6 meters wide. We captured bats. We keep them in these little cotton bags, because sometimes one net would be full of bats. There would be like 20 bats in a net.
Oh my.
So we'd have to get out the bats as quickly as possible, put them in a cotton bag, put the cotton bag on a little rope, and then take the next bat out. And then we would close the net, because we would have to process all the bats, right? We'd have to identify them in the field.
Right.
Take all the bad flies off, sex them, get some other features. Sometimes you have to look at the teeth to do identification of them. Yeah, you would have to look at the wing size, the size of the forearm, I mean, you know, some of the other features of the fur and all that. So we would also take wing punches to be able to get a DNA sample later on if needed. We would also take, you know, other notes, everything that was of importance with every bat specimen. We'd figure out whether it was pregnant, a juvenile, et cetera, et cetera. And then we would capture the bat flies and then we would release it again. Sometimes if there were fruit bats, we would give them a sugar water solution because sometimes bats get very upset when they're caught. They're very distressed. So before they can fly off again, they need to get a little bit of energy. And so we give them sugar water and then they fly off nicely again. We did that for probably 7 nights in a row in different sites. So we had sites that were secondary forest. We went in the middle of the forest, sometimes at the side of the forest, like, you know, bordering an open area, just to figure out different spaces and different flying routes of bats. And then a few times we went to the primary rainforest, which took us a few hours to get there. But it was rewarding because we'd get different bat species. And of course, different bat flies.
And what I'm struck by is you guys are cataloging bat diversity in a very methodical way as well. I mean, did you have right. anyone there who was kind of an expert on bats, or were they relying on you to be that expert as well as an expert on the fungi?
So when I put my team together, I was interviewing for field assistants. I was planning to have two field assistants. But in the end, there were so many great people, and I got it to work funding-wise that I invited five people for that expedition. And they were all bat specialists, which was great. So we were all not necessarily bat specialists of Panama, of Central America.
Right.
But they were able to deal with bats, because that's an important thing that sometimes might be forgotten, right? You have to be able to handle bats. You have to be able to not be bitten.
Bats are scary. Yeah, I don't want to get bitten.
Disentangle them from a net, because usually what they do, they fly in the net, and then they don't sit still, right? They just keep on trying to wrap themselves out of the net. But the more they flap, the more they get entangled. So sometimes a single bat can take half an hour to get disentangled if it's really, really, really upset. And of course, there were vampire bats that have super sharp teeth. So those bats, they need a little careful processing. So it was good to have experienced team members in Chukanti because they could help with that sort of thing.
I think for a lot of listeners, that's kind of the worst case scenarios. You imagine getting a bunch of vampire bats that are upset, trapped in a net, and were you having to do this work of disentangling and actually cataloging? Did that all go on in the middle of the night?
It all went fine, actually. We had never a situation when things went wrong. You know, there's sometimes stressful situations when there's many bats in all of the nets. That's stressful because you need to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? We are here only with 4 people. We have 60 bats hanging our nets. What do we do? so then we take the decision to just disentangle bats and release them immediately. Just it's a matter of just getting rid of them. You don't want to get them stressed out too long. Right. You don't want to just keep them just for the science. You want to make sure that they're also doing well, because they stay, you know, are mammals after all, right? And so they have, yeah, they have feelings and so all that. So we want to make sure that we're doing good for them. In all the years that I've done it, we've lost 2 bats specimens. Hmm. One inexplicably, well, and the second one too, actually. The one was hanging in the bed, in the net. Have that as well already. And I don't know exactly what happened with it. That was in Honduras, in Cusuco National Park. We were basically wrapping up nets, and one of the nets that I was checking, there was a bat in there that we had missed, or that had flown in like at the end of the 6-hour window that we usually go out to miss net. When I got it out, I felt that it was very weak. It wasn't doing much. So we tried some sugar water, but it didn't do anything. So we processed it very quickly, and then we tried to release it, but it wouldn't fly off. And then, you know, after a few minutes, I just noticed that it was in my hand and it was not alive anymore. So everybody was kind of discouraged, but, you know, we took it to the campsite where the sleeping arrangements were and where the lab was. We put it in ethanol because that's the only way you could really keep it, because we wanted to look at it much more closely during the daytime. And so we figured out that we had identified it incorrectly at the time, also because we wanted to do it quickly. We didn't want to stress it out. So we were always doing it, you know, trying to do it as fast as possible. In the end, the day after, we found out that it actually was the first record of a certain species in Honduras. And so every time you make a new record or any species, you should have a voucher. So in the end, it came in handy that the specimen had died on us, because we needed the specimen as a voucher. And so for science, it was great. It was all a little bit sad because we lost the specimen, but It didn't just die for nothing. It wasn't just, it actually will serve its purpose, because we'll keep it in the museum where it can be studied by researchers.
And I'm sure that made everyone actually feel a lot better, because I'm sure in working with these animals so much, you guys must get really attached to these bats.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have favorite bats and all, yes.
For the work aspect of it, you guys are looking for the flies that are parasitizing the bats. So are the flies then that you're looking for, can you know by the species of bat what parasitic fly may be on there? Are they that host specific? And then does that give you some insight into what kind of Arthrica you might find on that bat? Or is there a lot more crossover than that?
Sure. When they were studied, maybe in the 1970s or so, people thought that bat flies weren't host specific, but we figured out later on that it was mostly due to human error. Sometimes, like I said, you have to put bats in bags, right? When you collect them or you capture them, then you process them. But sometimes you use the same bag for another bat specimen. I mean, sometimes of a different species. But sometimes the previous bat had bat flies that are still in the bag, and then they jump on the new bats, and so you get these human errors.
Right.
So that may have caused some confusion in early literature. Now we know that bat flies are usually very host-specific, but some bat flies share hosts, some bat fly species. So you'll have, you know, on a given bat, there may be different species of bat fly that each may be host-specific. Labelbenialis. Well, there are several genera of Labelbenialis on bat flies, I should say. So in the neotropics, we have Gloendromyces. We also have Nycteromyces. In the eastern hemisphere is Arthrorhynchus, Dimeromyces, and Nycteromyces as well. So Arthrorhynchus doesn't occur in the neotropics. So some of these species of Gloendromyces, they do seem to be host-specific. The story about host specificity and speciation gets a little complicated here, because it seems that there's divergence by host, although not leading to speciation. So it seems that there's an event of maybe incipient speciation that we're looking at. But when I make a phylogenetic tree of all of the sequence data that I have for my different taxa, for my different isolates, and then I apply sequence-based species delimitation methods to it, then even though there are different clades that are host-dependent, the clades are not recognized as species. So I do see it as host divergence, but there's still one and the same species at this point for Gloendromyces. In the Eastern Hemisphere with Arthrorhynchus, the situation is different. It does seem that there are actually different species by host. But again, that's based on preliminary data. So we just need to do more work. And so one of the longer term goals here is to develop more collaborations, not only with mycologists, but also with bat researchers, with bat fly researchers, to develop these standardized fieldwork protocols so we can capture bats all over the world, preferably, screen them for bat flies, collect the bat flies, send the bat flies to these designated labs, and then screen those bat flies for Labelbenialis, then put all of those data together in a big database, and then, you know, use that database to resolve certain questions that we're interested in. So currently, I am building that database. We are at around 12,000 specimens of bat flies, which is a lot, but you know, it's not enough to resolve these bigger questions. From next year on, the idea is to oversee a project in collaboration with Operation Wallacea. Operation Wallacea is this UK-based organization that oversees these field sites in different parts of the world. So they have a field site in Honduras where I'm involved in Cusuco National Park. But they also have field sites in different areas, you know, in Dominica, Romania, Madagascar, also in Asia. And so the idea is to oversee a project where we'll do the standardized fieldwork that I talked about, and starting with field sites run by Operation Wallacea, and then hopefully expanding by working together with different people. And so the main idea with this data set is to figure out whether climate change, for example, has an effect on parasitism, whether habitat destruction has an effect on parasitism. So all these questions we may be able to solve using a data set that's unbiased and that's complete, so tritrophic and large. So many, 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 many specimens. We're talking about tens of thousands of specimens.
And you just answered one of the most pertinent questions I had, which is kind of the goal of the research and what the bigger questions that you get excited about in doing the work you're doing there with bats and Labobinielis. And it sounds like just mapping out the phylogenetic tree and the basic biological interactions across these different trophic levels is a lifetime of work in itself.
Yes. I'm doing a lot of taxonomy right now and phylogenetic work and molecular-based taxonomy just to figure out what are the species limits in this system.
Yeah.
And we're doing the same with the bat flies, actually, because the bat flies haven't particularly been worked out well.
Oh, wow.
And so that's a little bit of a smaller project because I'm not, you know, an entomologist per se, but we do have some data to work with. So once we figure out the taxonomy part, we can really start looking at placing them across phylogenetic tree. And we're probably talking 5 years down the road now. So once we figured that out, then we can really start working on the bigger questions that I was talking about, dealing with climate change, dealing with habitat changes. And so one of the things one of my students is working on right now, he's working with his 12,000 specimen data set right now to see if there's an influence of these abiotic traits such as temperature and humidity on parasitism. And just to see if we can see preliminary results using this data set right now and to test methodologies we want to use once we have a larger data set. It won't be the end game yet, so to speak, but it is a start at a hint at what I would like to do with this data set, yes.
Well, and I'd imagine some of these methodologies are then going to be able to be extrapolated into other questions of ectoparasitism and, you know, even outside of Labobinielis.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, one of the other species that I know that you've talked about in your work is Herpomyces. I don't know how closely they are related, but it sounded like it was kind of another one of these cryptic pathogenic fungi.
So there's two parts to this. One, yes, there's a growing movement, I think, towards the conservation of parasites overall. Mm. And so resolving questions like effects of biotic and abiotic factors on parasitism, they are important in that regard. Second, well, and we do know that it's important to conserve parasites because parasites are such important components of our ecosystems. They're such important drivers of speciation overall. So we shouldn't disregard them like all too often it's done. Second, Herpomyces is a genus, a relatively small genus with some 26 species in Herpomycetales, which is a sister order. Well, not a sister order, but an order close by to the Labobinielis. They also have these three-dimensional thalli. They're also very small in size. Basically, I would say they share a lot of characters with Labobinielis, to be short. And for a long time until last year, they were considered to be part of the Labobinielis, but we did phylogenetic work and found that they actually represent their own order. And so we know now that the class of the Labobinomycetes, to which those both orders belong, consists of three orders in total, and also two lineages that are currently unnamed, and they're currently unnamed because they consist of very few members that we do not fully understand yet. So one of these clades consists of Labobiniopsis, which is a termite-associated ectoparasitic fungus, which also forms a very, very small thallus. But there are currently only two sequences available. So you can't really do a lot of phylogenetic reconstruction with that. So that's one of the lineages. The other lineage in the class is, we call it Contranciopsis. That's a lineage of fungi that we do not understand yet at all. Like, they have a life history that we don't understand. They're simple asexual termite-associated fungi. But we recently found, in a 2020 paper, we found that in asexual species that we found in New York sewage systems, that genus, Tuberomyces, also belongs in that clade. So how do termite-associated asexual fungi relate to a sewage fungus? I have no idea. So this is an interesting clade that we need to get to know a little better before we can actually formally name it. So what I want to say is Herpomyces is really close to Labobinialis, but different. And we know that because of developmental features. Even though they're both thallus formers, you would think, okay, they both form thalli, so they're the same thing. But the development of these thalli is very different. Ultrastructurally, they're different. Their sequence data is different, and their host usage is different. So Labobinialis have very different hosts, all in the phylum Arthropoda, whereas Herpomyces is only associated with cockroaches. So it's a very small lineage of cockroach-associated fungi. And so what I think has happened in evolutionary history is that formation of thalli has happened at least twice independently, which is quite exciting because we have this thing that we throughout history thought of to have a single origin because it's so weird to look right at this thallus thing. But in the end, I do believe that they have developed independently in two lineages independently. Yeah.
The thalli would seem like this defining characteristic. It's hard to imagine any kind of convergent evolution where this would be a form that multiple organisms would adapt to. Describing something like this can get incredibly complex. But in general, what is a thalli? And then how does that work as a mechanism for all of these kind of cryptic ectoparasitic fungi we're talking about?
So a thallus is a three-dimensional structure consisting of many cells. It's like a parenchyma tissue, but three-dimensional. It consists of, a few hundred to a few thousand cells maximum. And what's really interesting about a thallus is that it is determinate in growth. So every cell has a certain destiny in where it'll end up or where its daughter cells would end up. And there has been a few studies that have done developmental work, and they were able to see what cell of the original bicellular ascospore becomes what final structure in the mature thallus.
I mean, that's an insane concept, the idea that these cells developmentally, we can map out exactly where they're going to end up, like it's being manufactured
right in a factory. And that's also how these things are very different compared to all other fungi, right? Because all other fungi, they just keep on dividing, right? They just form these hyphae and they divide, without any determination per se, right? So it's very different. And that's what makes them so special, I think, within the kingdom.
And when I look at the pictures of these obviously tiny fungi, it looks like the form of the thalli looks like a root almost that's puncturing into the host. Is that what's going on there?
Sometimes. So that's a good point to make. So some fungi in the Labobinialis, they do puncture their host and they form this root-like structure, like you said, which we refer to in the field as a haustorium. So that haustorium makes our root-like structure, whatever name we use. It punctures the host. It makes contact with the hemosule, which is the body cavity of the host, to which it absorbs nutrients. So we do see that haustorium as a organ through which the thallus gets its nutrients. However, interestingly, there is a number of species that have been found not to have a holstorium at all. So what some of my colleagues did, they took off carefully the alae of Labobenialis from their host, and then they took these electron microscopy pictures of the integument to see if there was any penetration, and they didn't find any penetration repeatedly under those thalli. So with confidence, they said, we could not find any penetration, which means that these thalli are superficially attached, which really brings the question, how the heck do they feed? What right. do they feed on? And, you know, you can say a lot about, there's a few theories about feeding strategies of Labobenialis. Some say that they absorb through specialized appendages through the air. Very simple. And others say that they absorb waxes and everything that might be available from the integuments. But there's really no research done, like literally none, to this sort of question.
To what would seem to be a really fundamental question.
Right.
How these organisms operate.
We're talking about these really tiny things. You need to, when you do this sort of research, you need to have living hosts. You need to have living specimens, and all that is complicated, right? Because you need to have an ongoing colony of infected specimens. And I did that in my work during my PhD. I kept cockroaches with herpomyces, and I kept ladybirds with hesperomyces, which was great. It was fun, but it took a lot of time. And some of my colonies, you know, inexplicably just died off, or the infection wasn't successful, or, you know, there's so many things that go wrong. And sometimes it just almost seems impossible to keep hosts alive. Like with the bat flies, there's a lot of questions that I would like to resolve with the bat flies. For example, do Labobenialis harm them? Do they have any effects on their fitness? But keeping bat flies alive is almost impossible because they do need a very common blood meal from their host. So if you want to keep bat flies alive, you almost need to keep bats alive or need to have some sort of blood reservoir.
Yeah, so you would start needing to keep a potentially pretty grotesque terrarium full of either bats or blood that the flies are right. feeding off of. That,
and you can't just keep bats, right? Because they're mammals. So there's a lot of regulation around
keeping right, those right. things.
So yeah, that seems to be a bit of a struggle. So we'll see about that.
Well, and you just brought up another really fundamental component of these fungi. I think when people think of parasitic fungi, we all conjure in our heads this image of the very famous cordyceps fungi and how that operates, where, you know, it kills its host in a very vivid fashion, protruding out of its body, emerging from its body. But do Labobenialis kill their hosts? Do they, you know, what is that parasitic relationship like? And it sounds like that's another area that's kind of up in the air and needs to be discovered.
Right. That's a great question. And one that hasn't been tackled yet a lot.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say, just a few weeks ago, we published a paper on that very topic where we did publish the results of these bio essays that we did on ladybirds. So we tested whether ladybirds infected Hesperomyces showed higher mortality compared to ladybirds not infected with Labobenialis. And so the way we did this, the way we approached this, you need to do all these bioassays, you need to do this properly, right? So we collected ladybirds in the field, we got eggs, we used the eggs to create a new set of ladybirds, a new generation of ladybirds, and then we used those ladybirds to lay eggs, and then we used those eggs as starting point for our experiment. So we had many eggs on the same day. We grew those specimens out as the ladybirds that were going to be the adults in our test. So we knew that they were all the same age. That was important, right? And then we infected a subset of them with Labobenialis. And the way we did this was interesting. We collected more ladybirds from the fields, and we put those ladybirds that were highly infected with Hesperomyces together with those ladybirds of all of the same age in these test tubes. And we put the test tube, we closed the test tube, we put like, you know, two or three uninfected ladybirds, all of the same age, together with those field collected ladybirds with Hesperomyces. We put them in a test tube, closed the test tube, put the test tube on a hot dog roller and let it roll. So the reason we did this was because then that way the ladybirds had to continuously fly, and they would interact with each other. How would you otherwise make them interact with each other, right?
And you said the reproduction of the Labubinielis relied on contact.
Yeah. So the parathecium needs to touch a host so that it releases ascus spores. And so that direct contact really helps us to create a set of ladybirds of the same age with Hesperomyces. So we let it grow for 3 weeks, and then we had a set of ladybirds with Labubinielis and a set of ladybirds as control without Hesperomyces. And then we did our test, and we found that native ladybirds and invasive ones as well were both killed off statistically more or underwent faster mortality compared to the non-infected ladybirds.
Hmm.
But then we did something really interesting. We did a second infection with an entomopathogenic fungus. I don't know if you've heard about Bovaria bassiana or Metarhizium rhineum. Those are these entomopathogenic fungi. So we made these spore suspensions. And so what happens is we dipped the ladybirds in the spore suspension.
Okay.
And then the control was a suspension without the spores. So we used the same treatment, but we just used water without any spores in there. And then we saw that the native ladybirds almost underwent 100% mortality, 90 to 100%. They were all killed off pretty much. Whereas the invasive ladybird species did not undergo additional mortality. So that was really interesting to see that difference there. And we do believe that there is a fact that comes into play that we refer to as the enemy release hypothesis, that states that invasive species undergo less pressures of natural enemies when they invade a new geographic area compared to the native species. So that's what we think is going on there. In short, we do have the evidence that Hesperomyces causes mortality in ladybirds, but of course we need more data, right, to figure out if this is a common trend in Labubinielis. Also, Hesperomyces is one of those species that has an observable haustorium, that root-like structure.
Right.
So we need to do sort of the same testing with these bioassays, using species that don't have a haustorium to figure out if they also cause this higher mortality. But personally, I would probably say that parasitism or Labubinielis being parasites, it probably is a continuum that they occur on, where some of them are less parasitic than others.
That would make sense. I think a lot of the concepts we're talking about seem to lie on a continuum, whether a continuum of species complexes, a continuum of how they operate. That seems to be a common theme, is less definitive borders and more things along a continuum. And that concept you just brought up, that really gets to the heart of why research these small, hard-to-find fungi that are incredibly specialized and present all these challenges that may ruin a master's thesis. And I think that idea, plus some of the things you mentioned about the importance of parasites, really gets to how actually important it is to understand, right, you know, how these parasites operate and how they live.
Right. And part of the reason that we wanted to study that one question, the mortality of ladybirds, was because that invasive one, Harmonia exiguitis, is such a big problem around the world. It causes so many issues to native ladybird diversity that we are looking at all different possible avenues to find ways to control populations, not to just root it all out, but to control populations, because it has also good effects, of course, right? It was introduced as a biological control agent against scale insects and pest species that were destroying rose gardens and all that. And it was a good control agent until the control became out of control and the population, you know, they weren't controlled populations anymore. So it got introduced, it was introduced in the wild, and it became established in the wild. And so populations just grow and grow and grow. And then there were these different populations in North America that then just started to spread around the world. And now this invasive ladybird is just super prevalent all over the world and pushing back populations of native species of ladybird. So this Hesperomyces paper was really looking at the idea of potentially using this species as a biological control agent against the invasive ladybird. And, you know, we weren't actually hopeful that it would work because there hasn't been any study of Labobini elis showing that they kill their host. But the results are quite interesting. And knowing that we actually now we know that the native ladybird that we tested and the invasive ladybird that we tested have different species of Hesperomyces, right?
Yeah.
Because we did this other paper where we figured out that Hesperomyces virescens is a species complex. So now we know that even though at the time we thought we tested the same species of Hesperomyces on these different ladybirds, we know we actually tested one ladybird with its species and another ladybird with its own Hesperomyces species. So we should really test to see if we cross-infect the ladybirds with the other Hesperomyces species.
Right.
If there is mortality happening there. If not, we could actually have a shot at using it as a biological control against the invasive ladybird. But that becomes quite complicated, maybe unfeasible even to get bioassays done of the amount that you need to do to have statistical support. But still, it's an avenue that I would like to get into as well.
Right. And there would be that challenge of making sure actual physical contact is made to these invasive populations out in the wild. And of course, the invasive population itself is a precautionary tale about releasing control agents. You know, that's one of the things that always stands out to me when we study any kind of parasitic fungi. The most obvious applied usage for that down the road would be to figure out the mechanisms, how this works, and then use it as some kind of biological control agent. And I know there are a lot of companies doing that, trying to patent different strains and use parasitic fungi as biological control agents. But that's really interesting to hear, you know, some of the pitfalls of doing that, to try to be mindful of the precautionary principle. And I just love you brought up the idea that aside from just that usage, there's this whole aspect of needing to conserve parasites for their role in a very carefully balanced natural system. It's something I think a lot of us don't always appreciate when we think of pathogenic fungi or parasitic fungi, is that they have a role in maintaining balance in whatever ecosystem they're in.
Right. Everyone plays their role.
Well, this has been incredibly enlightening to hear about this microscopic world of these cryptic fungi. I guess you would have a better kind of sense of this than almost anyone else on the planet. Are there other kind of mysterious clades like this? Is Labobini elis the last frontier of discovering fungal diversity? Or are there other cryptic fungal organisms out there like these different orders that we have yet to discover?
Well, I don't think I'm the only one on the planet who knows the answer to this question. Ha. But I do believe that there's more clades out there that we need to discover. And right before this podcast, I was actually looking on Twitter to a paper that I obviously haven't read yet, but a paper presenting a whole new phylum of fungi. And just a few years ago, there was a new class published, the Archaeorhizomycetes. And we discover clades, I wouldn't say every day, but they're still discovered routinely. You shouldn't forget, or we shouldn't forget, that of the estimated diversity of fungi, like between 2.2 and 6.1 million species are estimated to be out there, we've only described 145,000 or 148,000, right? So that's maybe 2 to 7%.
Right.
That's it. So it's not hard to imagine that there's many clades out there that we haven't discovered yet. And so, yes, I'm pretty convinced that the Labobini elis are not the last remaining clade to be resolved.
Clearly not. We're in the single-digit percentages.
At the same time, I can imagine it'll take a lifetime or two lifetimes to, you know, do research on these Labobini elis to make them better understood.
Like I said earlier, I just think that the work you're doing now extrapolates to these other yet undiscovered fungi potentially. you know, when we start getting into this microscopic world, the techniques you're using, the protocols you're developing, I could see that then being applied in some of these other areas. Maybe it's just other organisms, you know, maybe, you know, they aren't parasitic, but they're still microscopic right. and have some of these interesting features that you're paving the way to identifying and isolating. Right. Yeah, it's a really exciting frontier of fungi. As much as mycology feels like kind of the frontier of biology right now, and maybe that's my own prejudice, it seems like you're kind of on the very frontier of discovering fungal organisms. So really exciting stuff.
What can I say? We do what we can. And I'm always excited to... So my research program I gave it the title, Pushing the Boundaries of Fungal Exploration.
Yes, that is what you're doing.
And I have these different themes that I'm exploring. But the first theme is really just thinking about understudied fungi and understudied habitats. And so I'm really excited always about this basic thing about discovering new species, discovering new diversity, new taxa, which can be, you know, at every level, right? It can be new species, new genera, new clades, new orders, whatever, in these understudied habitats of the world. And understudied habitats don't necessarily need to mean cloud forest, even though I love the cloud forest and I love collecting it. And yes, please send me to more field trips to cloud forest. But, you know, one of the things that I'm always giving as an example in my postdoc work at Purdue, we were looking at a fungus that was one of the most abundant fungi we found on lettuce, on the leaf surface of lettuce, romaine lettuce. It was an undescribed red yeast. So I'm really thinking about the leaf surface of romaine lettuce as an understudied habitat. So it's close at home.
More and more, as I talk to mycologists and I talk to folks who do a lot of work in the field, that's one common theme, is that there are underexplored fungal diversity, but really biodiversity everywhere. And when you start to think from a fungal perspective, you start to think of a leaf of romaine lettuce, or you start to think of any surface around you, any organism, you said earlier, even a decomposing body as kind of an ecosystem.
Yep.
That just
That's
opens
actually an interesting one. So we're doing this research in a nature reserve in around Tilburg in the Netherlands. And, you know, the Netherlands is one of the most populated areas in the world, right?
Yeah.
And so you wouldn't expect to find new species there. And, right, you know, especially not after the renaissance of natural history, where a lot of the Western European people already figured out a lot of the diversity in Western Europe.
Right.
But still, so we are looking at decomposing bodies in that nature reserve. So we're looking at decomposing pigeons. We're looking at decomposing lobsters. And so we're finding all kinds of interesting things on those materials. And so one of the things we found was an undescribed fungus of Labobini ilis, which we described on that decomposing lobster. So yeah, I was so surprised that we find this undescribed thing in the Netherlands, although on a very interesting, never studied or, you know, not commonly studied habitat. So I think that's the most important thing, that those habitats that we're looking at, that's really crucial here.
And it gets to this idea that, you know, as much as we all want to like go out and explore space, we have an infinite amount of information to explore right here on Earth. When you get to the microscopic level, I mean, we've got so much more left to explore. And I think for a lot of people, that's one of the biggest pulls when it comes to really researching mycology and researching fungi. It gives you that feeling of a frontier yet to be explored, you know, in a society where we think everything is mapped out, everything has already been discovered. There's something great and satisfying to hear that, oh, there's still room for tons of exploration. You know, there's still a need for more adventurers, more explorers.
And it's not that we're only looking at microfungi in those habitats. You know, you also have macrofungi that we're still describing, right, from all over the world. Like I'm involved in several papers where we're describing species that are undescribed from Pakistan, species that are new from even the Boston Harbor Islands, the Drumlin Archipelago, you know, off the coast of one of the larger cities in the United States.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing that we we're just on the brink of discovering fungal diversity. We just started, basically.
Well, it's incredible. There's a lot of hope for the future, a lot of ground to be covered. If anyone listening had any doubts that they should pursue research in mycology, I hope this erased any doubt and has given them the call to go and explore all these unexplored organisms. But I guess, Danny, what are your plans for the future? You know, we've talked a lot about the research that you've done, research that's ongoing. But for you, I know you've just gone through a big move. You're now at the university there in Ghent. What are some future plans for you?
Well, that's a good question. So I'm in the postdoc phase, which means you're in between getting your PhD, which is a big thing, and hopefully at some point being a professor, which is another big thing. So I'm applying for jobs right now for tenure track positions, which is exciting. It's a new step, I suppose, in my academic career. I hope in the future to have my own lab where we could do research on lab albino yields and other fungi understudy plates. One of these questions that I would really like to solve or to work on in coming years is this idea of parasitism and biotic and abiotic traits affecting parasitism at different levels. So that's one of the things that I would like to keep developing. A fungal exploration is something that I have been interested in and I will probably stay interested in. It's also one of the ways that we can resolve the fungal tree of life is by finding more clades. So, you know, there is these funding agencies that may limit funding for fungal exploration per se, but I believe that fungal exploration has its value. Like, it's only by finding these understudied clades that you can actually sequence them and put them in the fungal tree of life and then, you know, resolve certain nodes that were at that time unresolvable. So that's another part. Yeah.
The work of many lifetimes to complete the fungal tree of life. And I'll be excited and I encourage everyone to follow your body of work because it is prodigious. It is interesting. I will throw out there too, I love reading your articles. You have a very enjoyable writing style. There's a lot of humor mixed in there. So it's a joy. The ones that are in English, it's a joy to read those and follow your work. But where can people find you and connect with you if they have interesting research or maybe they want to hire you? Where can people find you and your work?
I have an active Twitter account. It's a D Halewa, D, and then the first letters of my last name, Haelewa. And then I also have a website, dannyhalewaters.com, where I try to maintain an active blog. It doesn't always work. I do what I can. So those are probably the two ways to get in touch with me. And then, you know, of course, email. But Twitter is actually a really good way that I've established collaborations, have had good contacts with collaborators, friends in sciences. A lot of opportunities arose through Twitter. Like one of my postdocs, actually the one in the Czech Republic, everything that led to that postdoc started out with Twitter. So yes, Twitter is great.
That's like the best case scenario with social media and with something like Twitter is it actually leads to really exciting opportunities and connections like that and isn't just a time sink. But I will say I have found that Twitter, although you know I don't do a lot of posting there, an amazing area to find real proper academic mycologists and scientists of every stripe. You know, you're much more likely to find them on Twitter than say like a Instagram or a TikTok. So if people are interested in this, that's a great place to go to find and learn about the work of amazing academic mycologists out there. Well, I'll wrap up with the three questions that I like to ask all my guests. And like with many folks, I'll have to change the first question and expand it to be more appropriate for your body of work. But that first question is, what is a fungal organism that you love and why? Usually I say a mushroom you love and why, but we're dealing with fungi that aren't necessarily mushrooms. So what is a mushroom or a fungi that you love and why?
I thought about this for a long time and I can't choose or I can't pick one that stands out. Every fungus has its story to tell. And there's so many that I adore for many reasons. Maybe if I have to pick out one, it's not a species, it's a genus. And we talked about it already. And it's not in the lab of Benielis. What? I think it's Ophio, it may be Ophiocordyceps. Because it's such a mind-blowing genus of fungi that manipulate their hosts, turning them into these specimens that, you know, climb onto their plant host and onto a certain level that's specific, great for spore dispersal, right?
Yeah.
That is just so mind-blowing to me that that might be just one of my favorite clades to think about. And some species are so beautiful to look at. So they're not only mind-blowing in what they make their host, they're also just beautiful to look at. So yeah, maybe I'll stick with Ophiocordyceps for now. And they're also entomopathogenic, right? Which is something that I love a lot. So
I think it's no coincidence Ophiocordyceps hold a special place in the imagination of everyone from professional seasoned mycologists like yourself, all the way to people who are just getting introduced to mushrooms. That's right. One of the first ones people see that really blows their mind in terms of what mushrooms can look like and what they can do. So yes, I think that's one a lot of that holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts and imaginations. So a fantastic answer. And then a big general question here, but what has a relationship with kingdom fungi given to you? And that can just be new perspectives, new outlooks, new spiritual connections, whatever that may be. What has that relationship given to you?
That's a bit of a crazy question. It's so broad.
Yeah.
I thought about it for a second. Well, no, not for a second, for a few minutes, I guess. Just to think, maybe the answer for that question is just everything. I think the relationship with fungi has given me everything like that I am, like on an academic level right now. I delved into these parasitic relationships. These parasitic mushrooms, I interviewed for PhD positions, got accepted for a PhD program unexpectedly at a prestigious university, and now I'm interviewing for professor positions. All that is just mind-blowing to me. I come from a simple family. College was not necessarily written in the stars. I was the first to go to college. Wow. So everything that happened since I started thinking about fungi has been just fantastic and unbelievable. And so I'm passionate about my fungal work. And I think it's this passion that drives me to work so hard and, you know, reach some of the personal goals that I've had. So yeah, everything.
Can't ask for much more than everything. Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that way. It sounds like for you, fungi have given you that passion and purpose and, you know, a whole academic career to be proud of. So that's incredible. And then the last question, and we've hinted at it earlier, but what is the lasting impact that you hope to make with your work?
Boy, oh boy. Well, one of the things I hope is that my papers that I write are cited, right? That's what you want as a researcher.
Right.
So that's one thing. And I do hope that the work that I do on these understudied fungi, right now, they're just the level Benielis, but I hope, you know, we can expand this to other clades as well. My hope is that my work on these fungi makes that they are brought out of the shadows or brought out of the obscurity a little bit, and that we are going to be able to use all of these clades or consider all of these clades in broader fungal studies, be it ecological, phylogenetic, all that. You know, there have been several studies of named all Ascomycota white phylogenetic tree, and then you're looking for Label Benielis and they're not there. So it's not really Ascomycota white. So my hope is that by some of the work that I do, and this is why I publish open access, why I want to publish as good papers as published that are readable and not obscure, that are just gives these broad overviews of what these fungi are. So my hope is that in future, we'll be better able to do that sort of thing, use these fungi in these general fungal ecological questions, evolutionary questions as well. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, well, and I think you've done a magnificent job of that just in this interview. in communicating not only the mechanisms of these organisms, what they are, but also their importance. And for myself, and I'm sure a lot of listeners, you've added Labubinielis into our lexicon of fungi that we're a little more familiar with. So I think you're doing that work all the time. Well, Danny, thank you so much for making the time. Obviously, we're navigating time differences. You've been, just like I said, you've been just gone through a big move and you're starting new, whole new pursuit of work. So I appreciate you making the time and then being so generous to share your knowledge with us. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, happy to do it.